Welcome to Naked Word Radio and part the sixth of the Curious Chronicle of the Lost Heart, in which a man chooses his own death, another chooses his own heaven, and yet another chooses his own life. A melody resounds through time and a fox looks out at the dusk. Warrior, missing the target. The prow pressed painfully into my back as I searched the stars for signs in the sky above. Dawn was blushing shyly, reluctant to hide these celestial bodies from me. All around, men shifted restlessly, checking weapons or clutching amulets for strength in battle. I could hear the grunts of the men on the oars as they rowed steadily towards the shore. Spear shafts began to bang on the decks in time with their strokes. The warriors, men and women, working up their rage to overcome their fears. The grim reality of a new day rose at the sun, but I put on a hard face and waited for the grinding of the keel up the shingle. Shadows became clear, and the salt sharp smell of the shore reminded me of my first landing on the Northumbrian coast. As the eldest son of the Jarl, I am expected to be one of the first to leap over the gunwale into the crashing surf and up the beach, but a confusion of emotions battle in my mind. I can feel and hear the bloodlust brewing in the impatient warriors and yet cannot find it in myself. Time flows slow, thick as birch sap, and thoughts parade past my inner eye, broken into fragments. I see shards of fear, but not of death, splinters of anger, but not for killing. A sliver of hope shines briefly as I consider hiding out of sight, but such is the rage and pride in death and destruction around me that I'd never get away with it. Suddenly I snap back into the present as we are all jolted out of balance, a ship sliding up out of the water. The monastery is out of sight, but barely a half mile away, a few minutes hard but silent running. At dawn the monks will be at their prayers, leaving no one but a few potboys to keep watch, and perhaps placing too much trust in their single-minded God. I know that blood, gold and silver are on the minds of the men surging up the beach beside me. There is no glory in killing defenceless monks, and little chance of leaving this life of Valhalla in plundering the monasteries and villages that struggle to survive along these shores. We will be gone before the local Lord's militia even hear that we have landed. The rhythm of our progress punctuates the conflict in my mind, each pounding step increasing my anxiety. I am truly struggling with the prospect of committing willful murder on men who are simply expressing their devotion. We cross the brow above the beach, and I see the monastery nestled in the crook of a small valley. Lazy wisps of smoke curl above the thatch. A cockerel crow can just be heard. Pigs are rooting in the remains of last night's supper, tipped into their run by a couple of boys who are walking, heads down, back into the kitchen. Part of me wishes that they look up and see us so that they can shout a warning, but we run into a gully, winding down towards a cluster of buildings and are out of sight. Suddenly, we round a corner, and the open gate offers no resistance to the surge of men who burst in on the peace of this small community. As one of the first in, I make for the only two-story building. Set in the middle of this muddle of houses, made of stone, sturdy but squat, it contains a courtyard in its centre. I pound up the stairs, relieved that so far I am on my own, and kick the first door I come to. It swings open, revealing a room, the walls lined with shelves and dimly lit by a square window. Books, rolls of parchment and vellum are piled untidily on every available surface, including a well-worn oak table, behind which stands the abbot. His face is wet with sweat, little beads trickling down his blood-drained skin. He is clutching a leather-bound prayer book in one hand and points the other at me, his mouth opening and closing, but no words come out. Suddenly finding my voice, I tell him to hide, to lie on the floor, pretend to be dead. But we have no common language. He stares blankly at me, holding the book like a shield. I wave my sword in the air, trying to express my meaning, but he cowers back, chins wobbling, and trips over a stool, clutching at the windowsill. Suddenly, his mind is made up, and as I gesture with my outstretched arms to calm the situation, he tips himself headfirst out of the window. Rushing across the room, I knock books and scrolls everywhere and look out to see the abbot lying motionless on the ground, his head twisted to an unnatural angle. I cannot stop the wave of grief and despair that wells through me, burning to anger at this stupid loss of life. A shout in the doorway behind me startles me, and I see a flaming torch thrown in and landing amongst the papers scattered across the floor. One of our men waves me out and urges me on through the building, breaking doors, rifling chests for treasure, and setting everything alight. We gather by the gate. Two donkeys laden with leather panniers stuffed with cups and coins, gold and silver. One of the warriors wields a golden cross, swinging it at a cowering monk and dispatching him to his chosen heaven. The boys I saw earlier lie in a pool of blood, no way of telling whose, as bodies are strewn wherever they were felled. Dogs are already licking at the bodies, and the heat of the burning building scorches our backs. The path back to the boats is filled with the jubilation of the warriors and is in stark contrast to the silent and deadly intent of our outward journey. Men and women boast of their sword strokes, but I am sickened by it all and secretly long for the company of my harp. They are used to my silence, thinking it just the way of the oldest son, a young man keeping his distance to preserve his authority. In my mind, I hear the notes of a haunting melody. They are as real to me as if I was actually playing them. I know I have never heard this tune before, but there is an overpowering familiarity about it and an air of timelessness. The sensation is so strong that I lose my balance and sit for a moment beside the track, my head in my hands. I suddenly come to. The room is dark, and my head is resting on my arms, which are folded along the yellowing notes of my old upright piano. I can hear a sequence of notes echoing distantly in my mind. Sitting up, I find them, pick them out one by one, commit them to memory, sensing the shape of the melody. I follow its questions and answers, lose myself in its honey-sweet loneliness as I play it round and round, fitting chords and harmonies. Satisfied that I've locked this beautiful tune into my being, stored it in my fingertips, I sit up straight, switch on the lamp perched on the piano top, and move round the room, closing the wooden shutters on the tall Georgian sash windows of our house in Bath. This new melody is more than a lament. It's an ageless air, a haunting musical description of loss. For me, it describes a space between that which we are forced to be and that which we would dearly love to be. Time weathers everything. The relationship between partners matures, their sharp angles wear smooth, disappointments become immersed in an emotional landscape. Expectations crumble into dust or stand as an edifice to longing. For me, the High Priestess has become the Wand Queen, a woman of power, but not quite connected to it. She knows that she has lost something, but cannot tell what it is. I see the questions flow across her face. Has she lost contact with her spirit self? Has she misplaced the meaning of her life? Where has her independence gone? There's a world weariness in her eyes from holding the reins of our family, but hesitancy sits on her shoulders, whispering doubts in her ear. She has lost her self-belief, and confidence has slipped away under cover of the daily survival routine. But still, she has to sit in her favourite chair, a regal smile dressing her face. My reverie is interrupted when I hear the kitchen door close in the room next to me. I know that the Queen has just come downstairs from reading our three children their bedtime story. We live in a creaking, leaking Bath stone house that is struggling not to slip down the hill. There's no weather sill on the front door, and in the winter there are snowdrifts in the hall. However, we all love it, or at least I believe we all do. Just like our house, she and I are losing some of the mortar in our relationship. 11 years have passed since our Irish adventure, 11 years of love and music and children. We have lived both in the country and the city, in basements and bothies. We played folk music and also written our own contemporary songs, performing at festivals and clubs, once famously to a room full of goths who barely blinked during our entire show. I think it was the only time I've ever broken out in a cold sweat. Since being together, I've scraped a living in a variety of creative endeavors. Usually, they've demanded a high level of input with not very good financial returns. Currently, I have a workshop in the basement that contains the all-important wood-burning stove that keeps the damp and chill at bay. There's a kiln for melting glass, either for etched bowls or for fusing pigment when painting. There's a light box for cutting glass on and a large workbench for assembling the stained glass windows. Lengths of H-shaped lead section lie on the shelves. Coils of Tinman solder are piled untidily in a corner beside boxes of glass pieces sorted by colour. Sheets of glass are stacked in a rack, selenium yellow, cadmium red, cobalt blue. Some high quality that cuts like butter, some grainy and gritty, stubborn and awkward to cut, but streaked and swirled with colours. My fingers are black with lead and sliced here and there with the inevitable cuts. My apron is smeared and spotted with lead and bloodstains, pigments and the occasional crust of dried black putty. I love working down here in the days, or sometimes late at night, when there is peace and quiet. I long ago discovered that any tension in the house somehow affects how I cut the glass. It requires a relaxed concentration, a certainty in pressure on the sheets, to cut smoothly and accurately. Sometimes I exercise my own stubborn streak and try to work after the children come home from school. But if it's a cutting day, it's a lot easier to take off the apron, wash the lead off my hands, and make supper. The Wand Queen is expecting more from our life together than I am presently providing. My determination to eke out a living from creative projects is turning into an unwelcome obduracy for her, and our tolerance for each other is stretching thin. She has her own project, a successful shop dealing in costumes, but neither is that enough to provide our needs. The differences between us become ever greater. Neither of us is able to feel as though we are making the most of ourselves. We are losing sight of our vision of life and falling under the mundane spell of material existence. I have no choice but to get a regular job. Having lived in and around the Jordan City for many years, finding employment was not too hard. I started out as a driver for a shop fitting company, occasional work at first, but it soon became full-time, despite denting the brand new van once or twice. Fortunately, the company was more interested in the expensive furniture arriving intact. A regular income made many important and beneficial practical differences to our lives. But the spirit and magic that once inspired us was disappearing under a swell of disappointment for both of us. A day came when I returned home from work with good news. A couple of weeks previously, I'd applied for a job as the office manager with the company I was already working for. I carried the notion in my head that she would be suitably impressed with the status of this new position. Nothing like the romantic and spiritually fulfilling occupations we had once looked for, but certainly commensurate with the expectations of our modern life. I knew that the work and its demands would cement me further into a concrete reality, but it looked a price worth paying for the sake of our family. However, she was not impressed and I was left dazed and confused. Had I misunderstood the expectations made of me? Was I not giving enough of myself already? Both of us were struggling with fears over a loss of identity to the point where we could only shout at each other about it. Our kitchen was always warm and cosy and truly the centre of our domestic life. In the winter, we stretched cling film over the windows for double glazing and enjoyed the heat given us by the Rayburn stove. I traded this for a stained glass window I had made that edged a staircase. The central feature was an oak tree, sporting the fine grain and pale mysterious aura of that wood. Functionally, it served as a frame to hold the two halves of the picture. The tree stood on the brow of a hill. All around lay autumn's scattered leaves, and in the branches red squirrels climbed. A jay sat, unmoving, as another took flight. A fox, its back to us, sat on the very edge of the hill and looked out over a deep dusk sky, the horizon an ice cream blue, blending through the spectrum to a far space indigo. I often thought of that window and felt that it was probably the pinnacle of all my year's work in that craft. I never made anything like it again, and certainly It marked the beginning of the end of my attempts to be a professional. I'm sitting on my own in the warmth of this kitchen. The Queen has gone to bed, and I am left wondering the price of independence. At what point do I give up, and how much of me can I give up? It feels as though I'm almost stripped bare. What I perceive of me that makes my character alive is standing on the brink of oblivion. If I give any more of myself away, if I seek ever higher positions in the material world, what will happen to my spirit self? Will I lose sight of it? I sit, head in hands, a lonely candle flickering on the mantelpiece, the only source of light, and realize that I've reached the end of my tether. With a sigh, I snuff out the candle, walk through to the next room, and make up a bed for myself by the piano. And here ends the sixth part of the Curious Chronicle of the Lost Heart.